Hi, I'm Billy Duffy, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room today, he's best known for his work as a songwriter and guitarist for The Cult, but today he's here to talk about the second album by his other band, Color Sound. Please welcome the incredible Billy Duffy. Hello, Billy.
Howdy.
How are you doing?
I'm good, man. Good. No complaints. No complaints at all.
Are you in Los Angeles? Is that where you live right now?
Technically I live between Los Angeles and England, yes. I'm spending actually a little more time in the UK of late, mm-hmm. which is germane to talking about Color Sound and stuff. But I've just sort of been drawn back to the UK a bit more the last few years and started increasing the amount of time, you know, as I'm getting older. I don't know. Well, I'm in LA. When I'm in LA at the moment, yeah.
Well, these last few years, if I could have gone to the UK, I might have done that too.
Sure.
Billy, let's talk about this new album, Color Sound 2. It's going to come out July 16th.
Yes. And
now you did a Color Sound 1, but that was 22 years ago. Why so long between albums?
Life got in the way, you know, me and Mike's day jobs sort of rekindled very shortly after Color Sound. We did that thing in the 90s in the UK. And I've been pretty much been active with the Cult in this last 20 years. There was a period when I wasn't doing the Cult again in the mid 2000s, but I was pretty much at that point ensconced living in Los Angeles, and Mike was got very busy redoing The Alarm. He sort of reimagined The Alarm, right, and also had his solo thing. When I met him, he was more doing, in the 90s, when we did Color Sound 1, Mike was really more doing a solo thing and establishing himself as a solo artist. But I think doing a band again, with me with Color Sound, even though it was only for a couple of years, rekindled that, the positive aspects of being in a band with him, because obviously you've heard probably from a lot of musicians that it is a challenge over time to keep a band together, and you know, hats off to any musician, especially if they achieve any degree of success and financial security. They don't tend to put up with what they might have put up with when they had to, you know. So,
right,
you know, I think Color Sound, that original thing, rekindled Mike's desire to be, you know, part of a band and contribute in that way, as well as having a solo career. And that's kind of what, from his point of view, that's what ended up happening. And for me, you know, the Cult just kind of popped back into action. So it was funny. I mean, I think probably the music on the first Color Sound record, which still sounds pretty fresh because it's just basic, you know, honest rock and roll songwriting. Yeah. It's not trying to be anything that it's, you know, it's not. It basically was an album that, from my point of view, it probably would have been a Cult album, you know, my contribution to a Cult record, obviously. Yeah. And that was it. But I was very happy with it. And I was really happy with the period hanging out with Mike, because of basically it was a friendship, really.
Well, Mike and Jules have both been on the show, and there are not two nicer people than Mike and Jules Peters. I mean, just a fantastic guy. I would imagine working with him, is just a blast. He seems so positive, and he's so prolific too. I mean, the guy is always writing and releasing new music.
Yeah. I usually wind him up about that. I coined the phrase the busiest man in rock. I think with Mike, obviously Mike and Jules, anybody that knows them knows how great they are. And I think for me in the 90s, when the Cult kind of fizzled out in 95, it just kind of had run out of its steam. We'd had a few unfortunate legal things, you know, even after grunge, and there was, it just became untenable, even though I thought we made a really good album in 94, the eponymous Cult album, right. The Cult, the fan favorite. I thought that was a very strong record, actually, but we were sort of reimagining ourselves. But I think the strain of, you know, 12, 13 years of kind of constantly being in a band just wore us out. And I think Ian was the first one to jump ship, you know, but I think I was pretty fatigued too. Although I found myself in England in the mid-90s. Well, actually what happened was we were in the middle of a tour and Ian kind of left the band and I wasn't. It was a bit traumatic because it's all I'd ever done since 1983. So, you know, it was like a 12-year consistent run of being a part of this entity, and suddenly this entity no longer existed. And I was a bit lost. So I kind of was drawn back to the UK to kind of spend time with family and friends and things that had been somewhat neglected on my part.
Right.
Because I'd been a touring musician, and I know, you know, any musician who's been fortunate enough to have any success, you do have to make some sacrifices, and being a homebody is one of them. You know, you can't do that and be successful as a touring musician. So that's what happened. And in that period, I was back in England trying to just find out, like, you know, who Billy Duffy is, rather than I'm Billy Duffy of the Cult,
right?
You know, changing my handle. That's when I ran into Mike and just doing stuff in England. It was very low pressure and casual, and I think that's what was also was very attractive to me, you know. But Mike and Jules do emanate quite a lot of light and positivity, and
they sure do.
I think most people are aware of their own stuff with cancer by now, so you know their approach to life, you know, is somewhat, you know, grasping it with both hands and keeping busy, you know.
People without cancer should live the way they're living with cancer.
Absolutely. It's a very positive thing. And that, you know, it just was the right thing for me at that time.
Yeah.
You know, and it just sort of fell into place. There wasn't any real work involved. It just emanated from a friendship with Mike, and that's what Colour Sound was. And then unfortunately, I had a very, very difficult decision to make when I got a phone call in 1999 about getting the Cult back together. And it was a difficult decision, and it wasn't a difficult decision because I don't regret it.
Right.
You know, with the Cult, I've had an excellent 20 odd years since that time as well. So in a way, I'm fortunate to have gotten both.
Yeah, I mean, you know? There's singers and guitarists that are always thought of together: Steven Tyler, Joe Perry, Stevens, Billy Idol, and you know, Billy Duffy and Ian Astbury. We just think of you guys together. So for you, or even Ian, to break out and do something different, it's you know, it's refreshing for the fans, and it's probably refreshing for you as well. When you sit down to write songs with someone new, because you wrote with Ian you know, most of your recorded life.
Now
In 98, you sit down to write with Mike Peters. Do you have to get along socially and politically? And does all that stuff have to gel before you can sit down and pick up the guitars together? Or is music, can music be the bond?
I think that's a very good question. And I think the answer to it, unfortunately, is both of the things.
Okay.
You can operate on different levels. I know many successful bands where the primary writers have what I would call a very good working business relationship. And I would also say that there are a lot of bands who, who's, you know, the creative center of it are truly close friends. I think the former is more real than the latter. I think that when you're all in the back of the van together, you know, sharing hotel rooms and those experiences when you're young men, I think things change as you become an adult. Hopefully they do.
Yeah.
It would be pretty sad to behave like a 23-year-old when you're in your 60s. I don't know. Or fun, or both. I don't know. But I think, you know, growing old with a degree of, you know, dignity is good. But,
yeah.
But you know, sure. But doing it, there's a great way, you know, if you look at this many artists who've shown us recently that you can still maintain a great career, you know, when you get quote-unquote older. It's not what it was, you know. We're kind of... The lines have gotten a little blurred. So, but it's a lot of fun. And that, by the way, that's not to say, you know, when bands do that, you know, Mike left the Alarm
sure.
because he couldn't get along with the guys or certain elements or the thing of the Alarm. It's not like I, you know, me and Ian have a really good relationship and it's endured, you know, almost 40 years. And in the essence, at the beginning of the Cult, you know, Ian and I were just two guys who had a vision and a kind of a dream to do a band, and we were both fortunate that we ended up realizing that dream to a lesser or greater extent, you know.
Yeah.
And then you know, then you have to roll your sleeves up and do the work.
Right.
And that's you know, on many levels of and that's where my hats are off to bands who still continue, you know, my peer group, you know, if they can continue to still do it, you know, hats off to them, because you've got to kind of live it.
Yeah,
and
sure.
There's no explaining. You just got to do it or not do it.
Let's talk about the first Color Sound album. I have to be honest with you. I didn't know of this Color Sound album. A fan of the Cult, a fan of the Alarm. And for some reason, this eluded me until April 30th when I downloaded it, because it's available now. Everyone can go out there and find it on all the digital platforms. And, you know, I dropped the digital needle on track one, Under the Sun. We immediately get a signature Billy Duffy guitar intro.
Yeah.
this album is fantastic. I mean,
well, thank you. Yeah, yeah. I mean, thank you. It was done, you know, it was done out of a spirit of friendship and very, for Mike and I, it was in a spirit of kind of hands-on, do a DIY kind of thing, which was refreshing after being, you know, involved in the 80s in a kind of a, both of us were in somewhat of a corporate situation. Sure. I mean, the cult's always been on Beggar's Banquet. So when I say corporate, the cult had to, you know, work with corporate partners, but really in essence, we were always with Beggars. So we've had a great deal of control over our musical output. But with me and Mikey, it was very much a DIY project. It was kind of funny. I mean, we literally were recording some stuff. Mike has a slight better memory than me about what actually happened, but I do remember recording up in a guy's like barn up on the side of a mountain in Wales for real. And, you know, the owner was always out cutting up trees to put on his stove to keep the place heated because the heating was like windfall logs from trees. And it was just a good vibe and very refreshing and different for me and what I needed at the time. And the songs were really good. You know, the chemistry was there. There was excitement from Mike to work with somebody, you know, different and vice versa. You know, it was just a refreshing change, you know, for both of us at that time.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Well, and I've seen interviews where Mike talks about how Color Sound is a guitar-driven rock band, and he compares you to Tony Iommi and Steve Jones in some of these interviews, and he's not wrong. Billy, you have a guitar tone that's all your own, and you're just
guys.
Like if I hear a song and it sounds like Billy Duffy, when I check the credits, it's Billy Duffy.
Thanks.
How do you come up with it? How does that happen? Because I mean, all guitarists don't have it, but there are guitarists that do. The Edge and Brian May from Queen and Billy Duffy. I mean, you guys have your own thing.
I'm in very heady company there with all those names you've mentioned. Thank you. I do understand what you mean. Yeah. And obviously at a phase of my life, I've been kicking around a while now and I've probably spent a little more time reflecting. And I just think with all of those guitar players that you mentioned, possibly with the exception of Brian May, who I only found out recently his dad was a ukulele player. I used to just know that Brian May got the most phenomenal guitar sound I've ever seen.
Right.
Next to Steve Jones. Sure. Those are the two. And I saw them within a year of each other in the 70s play live. But I think that that's one of the things that's most important for young guitar players is to create your own sound and you know, you best kind of, in some ways it's luck and happenstance and circumstances with what guys you play with and that stuff. But one of the things that occurred to, in England when I was growing up, because of punk rock, I left high school when punk pretty much blew up in England in 77. And so did Mike, right? So Mike's a little bit older than me, but in essence, we were both fans of punk rock that learned to play. And I think that the punk thing was that you don't need to be able to play every single Black Sabbath riff or every single song to be in a cover band. You kind of did that for fun if you wanted to learn them, but there wasn't that culture of I'm in a covers band and I'm playing tunes and learning my craft by copying the work of other people. It was kind of the rule book got thrown away for a few years and it was just like three chords, a haircut and some tight pants and get on with it.
Yeah.
And I believe that foundation was different. So for the Edge, you know, I mean, clearly, if you look at all the, you know, what I consider to be a lot of the great guitar players, you know, the, you know, Charlie from the Simple Minds, Will from Echo and the Bunny Men, the guys in the Psychedelic Furs, anybody who was being progressive. I mean, there's many, Geordie from Killing Joke. All of the guys, I lumped us into this thing of we were the fans of punk, but we wanted to do something different. And we went on a, each guitar player was like, well, I'm not going to just do what Steve Jones did or Mick from The Clash or Brian James from The Damned. So we all started looking for different things. I happened upon a Gretsch because I was kind of into rockabilly a little bit as more of like a fashion thing. When the Stray Cats came to town, I was in London. I met Slim Jim. I always used to like rock and roll. When I was a little kid, my older brother had kind of rock and roll records. And so it's happenstance, and that foundational stuff is different. So to answer your question, I think that with that in mind, the game was always to come up with your own stuff and your own style and be experimental and fearless. And don't worry that I can't play Black Dog by Led Zeppelin,
right,
which I used to worry greatly that I couldn't play Black Dog by Led Zeppelin. And now I'm here by Queen. And I subsequently learned how to play both. And I feel much better about it self-esteem wise. However, as a 15-year-old and a 16-year-old, the rule book got torn up. And, you know, I don't want to over... I sound like one of the guys who was around when the Grateful Dead came up and like I'm an old hippie and peace. It's just what happened, you know. Right. That was my story. And a lot of the guitar players of you referred to, I think we had that background. And then again, you know, but there are guys like, you know, in later in life, I've really become to appreciate Tony Iommi. And Richie Blackmore, funnily enough, it's as I've gotten older, I've kind of gone backwards and started really delving into the, you know, the craft of what they did.
Gotcha.
Because I kind of missed them when I was a kid because of punk rock, and I went down a different avenue. My attention was drawn elsewhere. So I was aware of these bands and I was aware of it all, but I didn't get deeply into it.
Well, music never goes away, so you can always rediscover it. And that's...
Yeah.
Just like me in this first Color Sound album. I've been telling everyone I know about, and I've heard the new album too. And it's just so refreshing because this is exactly the kind of music I like. I just love it.
Yeah.
Mike's lyrics are great and your guitar is always great. When you're a teenager and you go and you're seeing shows and your dream is to be up on the stage, you know, where the Pistols are, when that finally happens, what's the feeling like? I mean, it must be unbelievable.
It's, it was quite an eye opener. You know, I mean, my ambitions prior to the punk thing happening in the UK was like, if I was trying to be a roadie for a local band in South Manchester who quickly changed their name and became a punk band. And as a lot of people did, and you know, very happenstance ended up that their guitar player left, and they said to me, "You look pretty cool. You can play a bit." You know, I was like 15. They said, "Do you want to join?" And I auditioned, and I got in the band, and that's how it happened for me. Prior to that, my only experience had literally been playing an old folks home, gotcha. Seriously, and. To a bunch of old people and a school dance, you know, that was, and we were doing anything from, you know, an eclectic set list that would be Born to be Wild, Woodstock, something by Fleetwood Mac, because somebody was into it, a Neil Young song, Ted Nugent,
wow.
First album, powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Sure. Not the early Nuge. I will never hear a bad word said about Ted Nugent. Early Nuge.
I mean, yeah, with Derek St. Holmes on vocals.
All that.
Out of the way.
Those albums are fantastic.
Yeah, the early stuff, peerless, sonically, simple, direct, great, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that was all the stuff. I mean, I you know, it's been well documented that I was a bit of a fanboy, so I would go to lots of gigs in Manchester, and I saw Nugent on his first British tour, Queen, lots of bands like that, Rush, Skinhead, Blue Oyster Cult. I saw them all play a place called the Manchester Free Trade Hall, or there was another venue called the Apollo in Manchester, and I would go and watch all these bands. And then, so I had that kind of fanboy thing. And then punk happened, and that was the stepping stone to make that some sort of reality for a lot of guys. You know, for me, Johnny Marr, obviously, who from the Smiths is, and many other bands, has been, you know, a close friend of mine since we were at, you know, different schools together.
When you say when you use the word fanboy, Would you try to meet the artist after the show too? Did it go that far, or you were just a fan of the music?
No. I wasn't into being a stalker or I didn't want to meet them or, you know, wrap my arm around them. And, you know, even if there had been a camera in those days, which there might have been Polaroids.
Right.
And I might have been able to steal one. No, it was never my thing. I like to look at them. Mm-hmm. I remember we'd get off school and we'd go into the centre of Manchester and we'd hang around backstage at the Manchester Free Trade Hall, and the car would pull up with the rock star, and they'd take four paces from the car door to the stage door, and we would just stand there. I remember seeing Willie DeVille from Mink DeVille.
Oh, nice.
Now, remember, I'm from a working class South Manchester estate, whatever the hell I looked like in those days, and out walks Willie DeVille with his whole New York. And I, by the way, didn't even like Mink DeVille. They were supporting a band I liked called Bebop Deluxe that were fantastic. Yeah. I didn't like Mink DeVille one iota, and I still really don't. But seeing him, he looked like an alien to me. I was like, who is this being?
He's got that swagger and that look. Like, it's when he's a rock star.
That's what I mean. He looks like a rock star. Right. I mean, he just exuded. And I used to kind of get off on that kind of stuff. And, you know, there was lots of stories. And then with the punk thing, I ended up meeting a bunch of musicians who were really cool. There was a fantastic New York guitar player. And I just heard this on a podcast that I listen to a lot, that a couple of guys I know do, Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt, the bass player who's played on everybody's record apart from a Cult record. But they do a great podcast. Anyway, they were referring to this guitar player called Greg Van Cook out of New York, who nobody's ever heard of.
Okay.
And he played on a Wayne County single. And the reason why I bring it up is I played this at my sixth form. Everybody got to play one song. And I can't really say the title because I don't know how PC this show is.
Oh, you can say it.
Okay, so everybody's playing like Stairway to Heaven and playing like, you know, whatever, Fleetwood Mac's The Chain. And then I walk in and I play If You Don't Want to Fuck Me, Baby, Fuck Off by Wayne County and the Electric Chairs.
If you don't want to fuck me, baby, baby, fuck off. If you don't want to fuck me, baby, baby, fuck off. I ain't got time for yesterday's news. Don't shoot me up with your bullshit news. If you don't wanna fuck me, baby, baby, fuck off. If you don't want a piece of the action, baby, take a walk.
Jules Holland played piano on it, which I just found out. I had no idea. The guy from Squeeze who's gone on to be somewhat of a TV celebrity. And this guitar solo still to this day was the most ripping. And I met the guy. Anyway, I met him when I was a kid and they played in Manchester at a club called Rafters. And I met this guy, Greg Van Cook, and he had a black Les Paul custom. And I just was like blown away. And in a way, I began to meet, when the punk thing happened, the punk musicians were more approachable because they were playing clubs to 200, 300 people.
Yeah.
not theatres to 2,500 with, you know, it's a different level and they're much more accessible. They're just there. You can kind of walk in. And I met bunches of them. I met Jerry Harrington from the Talking Heads outside a gig. They were playing at the Manchester University Students' Union. And the rule in those days was that an actual student had to sign you in to attend the venue because it's entertainment for the students.
Right.
And me and a guy called Stephen Morrissey, who went off to have quite a good career as a singer, were attending the show. We were stood outside on the steps and nobody would sign us in.
Why did you guys look rough? Is that why?
Well, I don't know what we looked like. We were a bunch of, you know, 15, 16, 17 year olds trying to combine thrift store chic to look like somebody from New York or London. And we were like wearing our granny's cardigans and stuff we could find in bazaar. Anyway, so Jerry Harrington walked us in. They were like, "What do you mean you can't get into our gig? You want to come and see the Talking Heads?" And later in life, you know, I ended up getting to know Jerry really well. Yeah. And I actually sold him a mountain bike. So, but it's a funny little thing. So that was very much my background as a kid. And to get it quick it back to Colour Sound, I know Mike had a very similar experience as a young guy. And he had like a punk band and they kind of faked their way onto a Stray Cats tour by telling the Stray Cats they were the support band. And the Stray Cats didn't really know. So, you know, there's all that commonality of experience with me and Mike, you know. So that's kind of my side of the story and what it was like growing up for me and, you know, prior to getting in a band.
So the songs on Colour Sound 2,
All
written by you and Mike.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And when you guys write songs together, is Mike all lyrics and you're all music, or is it a combo? Will you contribute lyrically?
I don't write lyrics. I'm the world's worst. That's my big disclaimer. I stay away from the written word. I can talk for days and you have been known to write a riff or two, but I don't do the words part. So with Colour Sound, Mike contributes. He has a couple of musical things that he thinks that might not suit the Alarm or him. So when he knew that there was a Colour Sound thing in the offing, he just kind of said, "What do you think of this one?" And that's how it worked. But it's mostly my music and all his singing and lyrics. And that's how we kind of, I think Mike more than me mentally, you know, he separates Colour Sound off by, with this band, I'm the singer.
Okay.
You know, he gets to just be a rock singer, not the leader or the, you know, head chef and bottle washer and all that. I sing in a band. This guy writes riffs. They inspire me. I write music. I write lyrics and melodies, and that's how we do it. Very simple. And it's funny. Sorry to ramble on a little bit, but
no, it's fine.
It's funny what you said. Pardon the pun. No pun intended there. You mentioned about the kind of music that you like. And I think one of the things about Colour Sound 2 was when me and Mike started, I sent Mike a riff that you know, wasn't deemed suitable for an upcoming cult record, put it that way. It was possibly a bit too cult-like, which sounds like the most ridiculous thing to say in the world. But if you actually think it through, the last thing you want to do is parody yourself.
Right.
So, you know, I'll leave it at that. But there was some stuff that wasn't really kind of in the right mood for what is going to be an upcoming cult album whenever it gets finished, but it's in the works. And Mike was just vibed and literally sent me back. I had like a bit and he immediately wrote a verse, sent it back to me, and we were off and running. And that was Paradise.
Something beautiful crashing through the noise and the sound of wonderful. Check it. I can see paradise to the left of us, flowers to the right in my own oblivion.
So that was the thing. We thought, oh, well, 22 years, we've still got it. And we just wanted to make a very simple, straight-ahead rock record for people who like simple, straight-ahead rock records in very complicated times.
Yeah.
Me and Mike just said, we want to make it sound, you know, as organic as possible, which doesn't mean to say that we're, you know, technophobes or anything. But the intention of the album, like the first Colour Sound album, was just to be an honest, fairly straight-ahead rock and roll record. But obviously the songs shape it. You can have that as an intention. Then if you write a load of folk ballads, you're not going to really carry out your intention. But that's where we were at. That was where my mind space was at. And it was for guys like you and me. I mean, I don't hear enough straight ahead, good rock albums.
Right. Yeah.
I really don't. There's just not, it's not something that's around. So I thought, well, I can still feel that I can contribute something that is good enough to put out there to the public, then, you know, I'm happy to do it. And, you know, in these circumstances, it was great.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite straight ahead rock albums from this past year was released by Ricky Warwick of Black Sabbath.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And Ricky's just fantastic. I love his music.
Yeah.
You brought up Paradise. That's the first song.
Yeah.
Colour Sound 2. I made some notes. I put this track as the perfect blend of what you do with The Cult and what Mike does with The Alarm. For me, that's just how this sounds. And I mean,
it's kind of like a calling card. I mean, I think once you've heard the whole album, it's probably the most like that of
right,
all the songs.
It kicks it off so that people that are new to Colour Sound
know who you're dealing with.
Yes. And it kicks the door open and you're like, oh, okay, here we go.
Right. It sets the mood, you know.
It sets the mood.
It's like a contextual statement, really. Right. Plus, it was the first one we wrote together in this era, so we felt we should lead off with that.
Yeah, and but the next 10 tracks are not carbon copies
no.
of Paradise. There's
no, not at all.
Tons of stuff, tons of textures throughout the album. Yeah. So who else is on the album? Because it's you and Mike, but then we have a drummer and a bass player and...
Yeah. Well, we did it. Smiley's on drums, who plays with Mike, and he played with Joe Strummer, and he's quite one of the important things we found was that we wanted to do this quickly, and I wanted the chemistry to be good. I didn't want it to be kind of lazy and just be like basically a Mike Peters thing with me on guitar.
Right.
You know, I was very mindful that. But Smiley really approached it from the right way. And every song was done in a fairly spontaneous way that we'd literally have the rough ideas. Me and Mike would have and then we'd sit together as a team. And the fourth member of the band was basically George, who is the engineer / producer / piano player / bass player on
okay.
the. So George did all of that. And it just seemed to be a balance that worked. And we'd just sit around and discuss how we were going to interpret the track and then go in and record it. Just kind of old fashioned. You know, it was just, we sat around in the control room with acoustic guitars. Everybody had heard the demo of the song and then Smiley. And it just seemed to work, you know, and I was happy that it felt spontaneous and rock and roll. And to me, it was also important, I think, to have a certain Britishness to it, which I don't know whether that comes across. I'm not the best judge.
I definitely think it does. Yeah. It's.
Do you understand what I mean by that?
I do. I know what you mean. And I love British rock and roll. So, no, there's definitely a difference between this and I can't think of someone to compare it to. But, yes, it definitely does.
Yeah, that was our intention, was to try and, you know, and it wasn't like, this seems to work. And, you know, I just always go with my gut, you know. Mm-hmm. I was having a really good time, you know. Smiley's contribution felt right, George's contribution. And George's role being the producer and bass player, and he's not really a bass player by trade, which I kind of like. I like bass players who are not really bass players by trade,
okay.
Which the bass players fraternity will hate me for, but I kind of like amateur bass players on my stuff. Because I don't know why, I just seems to fit better. But George's role, he kind of disrupts it a little bit. He didn't want it all to just be. He was the disruptor in the team.
Okay.
And he was kind of challenging me and Mike and saying, "Well, that bit's a bit, you know, ordinary. Have you thought about trying this?" And he was a vital cog, you know, in the process. And any band when the functionality between the members is there would have that organically. So we were fortunate, you know, to have that.
I know what you're talking about. There's a Sammy Hagar album from 1987, and Eddie Van Halen plays bass on it.
And yeah, yeah.
So I guess he's an amateur bass player on that album.
It's
fantastic because it just doesn't sound like the regular bass player.
I know we want to disparage bass players or bass playing, and I'm not.
Right. But
there's
that's
a mental.
What we're doing.
No, but I mean, Jamie Stewart, when he joined the Cult, he was a guitar player before he joined the Cult. You know, he literally handed over his guitar pedals to me, said, "I guess I won't be needing these anymore." And off he jogged and bought himself a bass. You know, that was fundamental to the sound of the Death Cult and the Cult. So, you know, it's not that I have had quite a lot of experience about, because like guitar players, and we think that bass is probably a little different than it really is when you're like a proper, deep, you know, high-end, learned right. bass player, of which I've had the good fortune to play with also. They do bring something on another level, but for something spontaneous and fun, like Colour Sound, I was happy with the way it worked.
Now, are you guys going to do, is Colour Sound going to be more of an entity this time out? Are you guys going to tour behind this if it's possible to do shows?
I mean, we'd like to play. We did play in the 90s. Mm-hmm. You know, it everything's so up in the air at the moment that all I could answer to that is, given the set of circumstances, not just in the world, but, you know, me with the call, Mike with his ongoing stuff with the Alarm, and he's literally is the busiest man in rock. We'd like to. We've talked about it. Yeah. We'd like to do some shows. So if something pops up that's a good opportunity that works, you know, in the same way, doesn't interfere or tread on the call or tread on the Alarm, then we'd like to, you know. Mike does a thing every year called the Gathering.
Yes.
That's sometimes a good fun way to play, you know, a little mini set. You know, I'd be open to doing some dates. You know, I want to play. I haven't played a gig since 2019, you know, so I'm frightened that I'm getting too comfortable to my pipe and slippers. You know, I'm beginning to be like, oh, I quite like this.
Yeah.
Not being in the back of a tour bus with a bunch of sweaty blokes.
Well, the thing about both of these albums, they just feel like they're meant to be played in front of an audience. Like these songs...
Just need
and deserve to be played. It's like they were written to be played live.
They're very live-ish and spontaneous for the most part. So I'd like to be able to do that. But so the answer is yes, we'd like to. No firm plans at this point. Yeah. Hopefully we can pull it together, you know.
And everyone understands that because of the circumstances with COVID and everything, that's what's stopping everyone from touring and doing shit.
Well, yeah, and there's going to be a massive log jam and traffic jam of people playing, and there's going to be certain bands who are uncomfortable playing because of many different reasons. I mean, to me, you know, I've always been like to fancy myself as a bit of a businessman. So I love to play a gig. I'll do the gig for free. I just want to get paid for the other 22 and a half hours of the day
right.
that puts me in that.
Yeah.
The travel and all that crap. So, you know, now back in the day when I was a young man and we didn't really think about making money from touring, our Four Seasons were very nice. I had a lovely old time. The problem was the cult used to end up finishing a tour in debt. So it's kind of a bit like reverse work. It's like going to work for a week, enjoying your job, and then having money deducted from your bank account.
Awful.
There were compensations, I'm not going to deny it, but there was a point in my life where I thought, right, now, this is a thing that we do as a living, yeah. and I would like to come home and get a paycheck just like any other mug. You know, I've got the greatest job in the world, but it is a job. And so, you know, that's a factor to all this stuff. But, you know, I mean, and hey, listen, the main thing is that I'm fortunate and I've been very fortunate to be able to write music and write music that's endured and still sells and gets played and used in commercials and movies and stuff. I am one of the fortunate ones. There are many, many dudes out there who are more like what I would call not journeymen, working musicians. They yeah. need to play to pay for their kids' stuff. They need right. to, you know, these are guys who have played music all their lives and gone on tours and worked in studios and stuff, and they're basically done
yeah,
for a couple of years, you know?
I think the general public feels that if you've recorded an album or you've ever played on stage, that you're automatically a multimillionaire.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's not the case. We know that. It's not the case. So yeah, these people, like you said, they do rely on touring to make money like anyone else.
Yeah. I know. It's funny. I don't want to disabuse people of the fantasy. I've been accused of being too telling it too much like it is. So
I think people need to know that way they'll more likely go and buy your music than, try to get it for free. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There is that. I mean, hey, you know, I think people will find out, but it's hard. I feel for those guys, and I feel for the people who have worked in the industry. And you know, the cult did what we could do financially for the people who were around the band when we could, and we've done our as best we could. And seemingly everybody's okay. So,
and you're referring to the people that keep the show going, the roadies, the lighting people,
all sound that
people, all that. You mean, you know, like the Rolling Stones, it's a corporation. They have hundreds and hundreds of people that would work for them. So they would hopefully be taking care of those people during the off time. I mean,
it's an interesting thing because there's not, you know, if you think about being in a band, I mean, there isn't really an official manual. There isn't a book like, you know, if you were to join the corporate world and have a usual trajectory through your career from being an 18-year-old person to retiring at 65, let's say, just hypothetically, you know, if you were to work in the corporate world and you do certain things and work hard and do all this stuff, there's a through line that you should end up at 65 with, you know, well,
with
that
all,
doesn't
all
exist.
Your ducks in a row. Yeah.
Well, if you know what I mean, like that's the normal lifestyle. So if you don't choose that option and you go for rolling the dice on rock and roll or whatever, that creative arts with no guarantees, no pension, no, none of that.
Right.
You know, it is a bit of a wheat from the chaff, sink or swim, survival of the fittest kind of world, and that's what you engage in and choose to engage in, and so you have to understand that those the rules are, there are no rules.
Yeah, it's almost easier for a kid in high school to become a doctor because he knows if he does this and this at the end he'll be a doctor. But
absolutely,
if you want to be in a band and play rock and roll, like you said, no guarantees.
No, and that's the difference. Yeah, you know, and difference. Yeah, so that's kind of the point of it all. But you know, and in the end of the day, you know, a look and talent and circumstance and all of the above play a role in the outcome.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
All right, let me, because I told you I'd only keep you for 45 minutes.
Okay, what do you need to know? Yeah, I'm chatting on the coffee was good this morning, so I'm on a caffeine high.
I love it. I barely got to any of my questions, so hopefully when there's a cult album out, you'll be back.
Yeah, absolutely. Hit me with a couple of questions. If there's a couple you really want to know, because I will just blither on.
I wanted to ask this about the album Sonic Temple.
But
it's not about the music. It's about the album cover.
Okay.
Because you are on the album cover. It's an iconic cover.
Yeah.
How does the guitar player convince the singer that you should be on the cover? Or how does that work?
Okay. Well, Ian Ashby's a very generous man and a very kind man. I'm more than happy to go on record and say that. He is the front cover. The entire background is Ian's head and hair and a microphone.
I got to look closer.
Ah, you see, the three of us are on there and Jamie's on the back cover. So that was the three members of the band at that time are on the sleeve. However, we did choose as a group to go for an iconic guitar image. Once we realized the album was going to be what it was.
Yeah.
We were looking at key images that we always referred to Pete Townsend with some of the images of him with the guitar on, I was fortunate enough to see, all that. And there was a picture of me on stage that resembled that image roughly.
Okay.
And it wasn't the same, but it was similar enough. We went, maybe, and we did, and it was funny, and I don't feel too bad talking out of school. We were all ready to go ahead. The sleeve designer was an English guy called Nick Egan, who worked with a few different bands and Depeche Mode and stuff. And everything was great. And then we were all set to go. And then he was going, are there any photos of me and you together? Like at the 11th hour, he literally had a little lead singer wobble for about 2 minutes. And there were some photos taken where me and him were together. And it didn't look anywhere near as good. It just wasn't, we wanted a stamp that said, enter here all those who want to rock.
Yeah.
And that's what that image, it's like the Clash album where Paul Simonon is smashing up the bass.
Yeah, London
Calling. Kind of like a pink and yellow, all it was we were looking for an image that sort of said, this, and Pete Townsend was one with the guitar. There was a Free album that had Free live, and it was just it was the Free story, and it had like it was Paul Rodgers' mic and the drum kit, and it was symbolic. I knew what I was going to get when I turned it on, and that's all we were looking for.
Perfect. That album cover is perfect. And again, you as a kid, when you saw that on the in the record store, you just had to pick it up. You had to buy that album.
It's been a very successful image, that one of me. I will tell one, because I'm at the age where I don't mind little secrets, I will point out that we did move my arm a few degrees on the clock because to fit between vert and the call.
Gotcha.
It wasn't actually where it was, because it's actually, anyway, we moved it a little bit. These days you could do it on your iPhone, but back in the day there was cutting and pasting involved.
Yeah,
but that's the only little shenanigans that went on.
All right, let me tell everyone where we can find all things about Color Sound and Billy Duffy. On Twitter, we are at colorsound_UK, and color is spelled C-O-L-O-U-R. I think that's
That's the British spelling.
The British spelling. So
the colonial spelling, yes.
So remember it, folks. Also on Twitter, at the Billy Duffy. With Instagram, colorsound.uk and Billy Duffy Official, and go to the website colorsound.uk, and that's where you'll find everything about the band. There's videos on YouTube of you guys.
It's Color Sound. I think it's .co.uk.
Okay,
that's the classic British, like you've got .com in America.
Right.
In the UK, it's .co.uk for some reason. That seems to be the British go-to. Okay.
Cool. The first album is out right now on all digital platforms. So download it. Go get it right now. If you're listening, go get it. And this episode is going to drop July 15th. So if you're listening right now, tomorrow is when you can purchase Color Sound 2. It's on CD, it's on vinyl, it's on digital download. And hopefully, you know, you guys, maybe you'll do a streaming concert or something. Who knows?
Well, yeah, we're open to it. We're definitely open to the idea of it. The only thing, and I've often said this to people, it's one of those other little things. It's as much work to rehearse to do one gig as it is to do
to rehearse
a whole year's worth of touring. I'm a real musician. I ain't great until I've had a few gigs under my belt. And neither's any real musician. And if you tell you they are, they're lying. You know, you need to get warmed up. You need to get into it again. So I'm always a little scared of doing those events.
Because
I'm a bit of a perfectionist. So I want to feel that I'm as good as I can be. You know, but that's just my own personal stuff. But I'm into doing something with Mike and Color Sound, absolutely. But it needs to be played live. So we'll figure it out at some point.
And with those streaming shows, you don't get the feedback you get from a live audience. So,
well, it's like playing a sound check, I suppose. Right. It's not something that we haven't been too enthusiastic about. Personally, you know, I'm not terribly enthusiastic about it, but I don't mind doing, I wouldn't like to do a whole gig.
Yeah,
because that has an arc to it, and it's a shared experience. I mean, a one-off thing, a couple of tunes, that's a different thing.
Gotcha.
But trying to present a whole concert through I'm not so sure that that's the greatest. Unless you're going to do it like Kiss did it on New Year's Eve in Dubai.
Go to Dubai and do it right.
That's doing it properly.
Yes.
You know.
All right. We've already mentioned Paradise, so here's what I need from you, Billy.
Yeah.
I need a playout song from the new album, but not Paradise, since we've already talked about it. And I will drop that in in the middle of the show. So what song from Color Sound 2 would you like me to use as the playout song?
I think do Revelation. Oh, no, actually do Lightning Strike. That's the second track. That's good. We just keep it rocking.
All right, cool. So thank you, Billy, for your time. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
And hopefully when a cult album comes out, we'll chat again. I hope to see you out on the road as soon as that can happen.
Yeah. All right, man. Good chat.
Thank you so much. And everyone, please enjoy Lightning Strike.
There's a lightning strike coming over me. There's a heavy sky underneath my feet. I said, hey now, this city's gonna burn tonight. From a lightning strike.
a lightning strike coming over me. There's a heavy sky underneath my feet. Hey, now the city's gonna burn.
Around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.